softly and ungraciously to the pressure. She drew down his head and kissed him. His lips touched, but did not press hers. They met, but did not join. In his sullen and angry silence he would not look. She drew still nearer and whispered his name. Then he broke out. He pushed her away. His petty jealousy and injured self-esteem poured out upon her. "I am not the heir to an earldom," he said. "I do not ride with a score of gentlemen at my back. They have some wonderful diamonds, have they not, Countess?"
"Felix!"
"It is no use. Yes, your voice is sweet, I know. But you, all of you, despise me. I am nothing, no one."
"You are all, everything to me."
"You were with Durand the whole time."
"I could not help myself."
"Not help yourself? Do you think I believe that?"
"Felix, dear, I tell you I could not help myself. I could not indeed. You do not know all."
"No, probably not. I do not know the terms of the marriage contract."
"Felix, there is no such thing. Why, what has come to you? How pale you look. Sit down."
For he had risen. "I cannot, Aurora, dear, I cannot. Oh, what shall I do? I love you so." End of part 2, chapter 10. Eleven of After London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Ruth Golding. After London, or Wild England, by Richard Jefferies. Part 2, Wild England, Chapter 11, Aurora. Felix fell on the seat beside her, burying his face in the folds of her dress. He sobbed not with tears, but choking passion. She held him to her heart as if he had been a child, stroking his hair and kissing it, whispering to him, assuring him that her love was his, that she was unchanged. She told him that it was not her fault. A little while before the feast, the Baron had suddenly broken out into a fit of temper, such as she had never seen him indulge in previously. The cause was pressure put upon him by his creditors. Unpleasant truths had escaped him, amongst the rest, his dislike, his positive disapproval of the tacit engagement they had entered into. He declared that if the least outward sign of it appeared before the guests that were expected, he would order Felix to leave the place and cancel the hearth friendship, no matter what the consequence. It was clear that he was set upon a wealthy and powerful alliance for her. That the Earl was either coming or would send his son, he knew, and he knew that nothing so repels a possible suitor as the rumour that the lady has a previous engagement. In short, he made it a condition of Felix's presence being tolerated at all that Aurora should carefully abstain from showing the slightest attention to him, that she should ignore his existence. Nor could she prevent Durand following her without a marked refusal to listen to his conversation, a refusal which would most certainly at once have brought about the dreaded explosion. She thought it better, under the circumstances, to preserve peace, lest intercourse between her and Felix should be entirely broken off for ever. This was the secret history of the apparent indifference and neglect which had so deeply hurt him. The explanation, accompanied as it was with so many tender expressions and caresses, soothed him. He returned her kisses and became calmer. He could not doubt her, for in his heart He had suspected something of the kind long since. Yet it was not so much the explanation itself, nor even the love she poured upon him, as the mere fact of her presence so near that brought him to himself. The influence of her steadfast nature, of her clear, broad, straightforward view of things, the decision of her character, the high, unselfish motives which animated her, all together supplied that which was wanting in himself. His indecision, his too impressionable disposition, which checked and stayed the force of his talent and counteracted the determination of a naturally iron will, these, as it were relieved. In a word, with her he became himself. How many times he had told her as much! How many times she had replied that it was not herself, but that in which she believed that was the real cause of this feeling. It was that ancient and true religion, the religion of the primitive church, as she found it in the fragments of the scriptures that had come down from the ancients. Aurora had learnt this faith from childhood. It was, indeed, a tradition of the house, preserved unbroken these 100 years in the midst of the jarring creeds whose disciples threatened and destroyed each other. On the one hand, the gorgeous right of the vice-pope with the priests and the monks claimed dominion, and really held a large share, both over the body and the soul. On the other, the Leaguers, with their bold, harsh, and flowerless creed, were equally overbearing and equally bigoted. Around them the Bushmen wandered without a god. The Romany called upon the full moon. Within courts and cities, the gay and the learned alike mocked at all faith and believed in gold alone. Cruelty reigned everywhere. Mercy, except in the name of honour, there was none. Humanity was unknown. A few, a very few only, had knowledge of or held to the leading tenets which in the time of the ancients were assented to by everyone, such as the duty of humanity to all, the duty of saving and protecting life, of kindness and gentleness. These few, with their pastors, simple and unassuming, had no power or influence. Yet they existed here and there, a living protest against the lawlessness and brutality of the time. Among these, the House of Thyma had in former days been conspicuous, but of late years the barons of Thyma had, more from policy than from aught else, rather ignored their ancestral faith, leaning towards the League, which was then powerful in that kingdom. To have acted otherwise would have been to exclude himself from all appointments. But Aurora, learning the old faith at her mother's knee, had become too deeply imbued with its moral beauty to consent to this course. By degrees, as she grew up, it became in her a passion, more than a faith, a passion, the object of her life. A girl, indeed, can do but little in our iron days, but that little she did. The chapel beside the castle, long since fallen to decay, was, at her earnest request, repaired. A pastor came and remained as chaplain, and services of the simplest kind, but serious and full of meaning, took place twice a week. To these she drew as many as possible of the inhabitants of the enclosure. Some even came from afar once now and then to attend them. Correspondence was carried on with the remnant of the faith. That no one might plead ignorance, for there was, up to the date, no written record, Aurora set herself the task of reducing the traditions which had been handed down to writing. When the manuscript was at last completed, it occupied her months to transcribe copies of it for circulation, and she still continued to make copies which were sent by messengers and by the travelling merchants to the markets, and even across the sea. Apart from its intrinsically elevating character, the mere mental labour expended on this work had undoubtedly strengthened a naturally fine intellect. As she said, it was the faith, the hope that that faith would one day be recognised, which gave her so much influence over others. Upon this one thing only they differed. Felix did not oppose, did not even argue. He was simply untouched. It was not that he believed in anything else, nor that he doubted. He was merely indifferent. He had too great a natural aptitude for the physical sciences, and too clear a mind to accept that which was taught by the one or the other of the two chief opposing parties. Nor could he join in the ridicule and derision of the gay courtiers, for the mystery of existence had impressed him deeply while wandering alone in the forest. But he stood aloof, he smiled and listened unconvinced. Like the wild creatures of the forest, he had no ears for these matters. He loved Aurora, that was all. But he felt the influence just the same. With all his powers of mind and contempt of superstitions in others, he could not at times shake off the apprehensions aroused by untoward omens, as when he stepped upon the adder in the woods. Aurora knew nothing of such things. Her faith was clear and bright like a star. Nothing could alarm her or bring uneasiness of mind. This beautiful calm, not cold, but glowing with hope and love, soothed him. That evening, with her hope and love, with her message of trust, she almost persuaded him. He almost turned to what she had so long taught. He almost repented of that hardness of heart, that unutterable distance, as it were, between him and other men, which lay at the bottom of his proposed expedition. He opened his lips to confess to her his purpose, and had he done so, assuredly she would have persuaded him from it. But in the very act of speaking, he hesitated. It was characteristic of him to do so. Whether she instinctively felt that there was something concealed from her, or guessed that the discontent she knew he had so long endured was coming to a point, or feared lest what she had told him might drive him to some ill-considered act, she begged him, with all the power of her love, to do nothing hasty or in despair, nothing that would separate them. He threw his arms around her. He pressed her closely to him. He trembled with the passion and the struggle within him.
"My lady calls for you, mademoiselle," said a voice.
It was Aurora's maid, who had kept watch.
"She has asked for you for some time since. Someone is coming into the garden."
There was no help for it. Aurora kissed him, and was gone before he could come to himself. How long the interview had lasted, time flies swiftly in such sweet intercourse, or how long he sat there after she left, he could not tell. But when he went out, already the dusk was gathering, the sun had gone down, and in the east the as yet pale orb of the moon was rising over the hills. As if in a dream, he walked with unsteady steps to the castle stable. His horse had been put back, and the grooms suggested to him that it was better not to attempt the forest at night. But he was determined. He gave them all the coin he had about him. It was not much, but more than they had expected. They ran beside him to the barrier, advising him as they ran, as he would go, to string his bow and loosen an arrow in the girdle, and above all, not to loiter or let his horse walk, but to keep him at as sharp a trot as he could. The fact that so many wealthy persons had assembled at the castle for the feast would be sure to be known to the banditti, the outlaws of the cities and the escaped serfs. They were certain to be on the lookout for travellers. Let him beware. His ears tingled and his head felt hot, as if the blood had rushed into it. It was the violence of the emotion that he had felt as he rode from the barrier, hearing and yet without conscious knowledge of what they said. They watched him up the slope and saw him disappear from sight under the dark beeches of the forest. End of part 2, chapter 11. Chapter 12 of After London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Ruth Golding. After London, or Wild England, by Richard Jefferies. Part 2, Wild England. Chapter 12, Night in the Forest. At first Felix rode quickly, but his horse stumbling, though accustomed to the woods, warned him to be more careful. The passage of so many horsemen in the last few days had cut up and destroyed the track, which was nothing but a green path, and the covered wagons had, of course, assisted in rendering it rough and broken. He therefore rode slowly, and giving his horse his head, he picked his way of his own accord at the side of the road, often brushing against the underwood. Still, indeed, absorbed by the feelings which had almost mastered him in the arbour, and thinking of Aurora, he forgot where he was, till the dismal howling of wood-dogs deep in the forest woke him. It was almost pitch dark under the tall beeches, the highest of the trees preventing the beams of the moon from illuminating the path till later in the night. Like a curtain, the thick foliage above shut out the sky so that no star was visible. When the wood-dog ceased, there was no sound beyond the light fall of the horse's hoofs as he walked upon the grass. Darkness and silence prevailed. He could see nothing. He spoke to his horse and patted his neck. He stepped a little faster and lifted his head, which he had held low as if making his way by scent. The gloom weighed upon him, unhappy as he was. Often as he had voluntarily sought the loneliness of the woods, now, in this state of mind, it oppressed him. He remembered that beyond the beeches the ground was open and cleared by a forest fire, and began to be anxious to reach it. It seemed an hour, but it really was only a few minutes, when the beeches became thinner and wider apart. The foliage above ceased, and the stars shone. Before him was the open space he had desired, sloping to the right hand, the tall grass grey-green in the moonlight, and near at hand sparkling with dew. Amongst it stood the crooked and charred stems of firs with which it had been covered before the fire passed. A white owl floated rather than flew by, following the edge of the forest. From far down the slope came the chattering notes of a brook sparrow, showing that there was water in the hollow. Some large animal moved into the white mist that hung there and immediately concealed it, like a cloud upon the ground. He was not certain in the dim light, and with so momentary and distant a view, but supposed from its size that it must have been a white or dun wood-cow. Ahead, across the open, rose the dark top of the fir-trees through which the route ran. Instead of the relief which he had anticipated as he rode towards them, the space clear of trees around seemed to expose him to the full view of all that might be lurking in the forest. As he approached the firs and saw how dark it was beneath them, the shadowy depths suggested uncertain shapes hiding therein, and his memory immediately reverted to the book of magic he had read at the castle. There could not be such things, and yet no one in his heart doubted their existence. Deny it as they might with their tongues as they sat at the supper-table and handed round the ale, out of doors in the night, the haste to pass the haunted spot, the bated breath, and the fearful glances cast around told another tale. He endeavoured to call philosophy to his aid. He remembered, too, how many nights he had spent in the deepest forest without seeing anything, and without even thinking of such matters. He reproved himself for his folly, and asked himself if ever he could hope to be a successful leader of men who started at a shadow. In vain, the tone of his mind had been weakened by the strain it had undergone. Instead of strengthening him, the teachings of philosophy now seemed cold and feeble, and it occurred to him that possibly the belief of the common people, fully shared by their religious instructors, was just as much entitled to credence as these mere suppositions and theories. The details of the volume recurred to his mind, the accurate description of the demons of the forest and the hill, and especially the horrible vampires enfolding the victim with outstretched wings. In spite of himself, incredulous yet excited, he pressed his horse to greater speed, though the track was narrow and very much broken under the firs. He obeyed and trotted, but reluctantly, and needed continual urging. The yellow spark of a glowworm shining by a bush made him set his teeth. Trifling and well known as it was, the light suddenly seen thrilled him with the terror of the unexpected. Strange rushings sounded among the fern, as if the wings of a demon brushed it as he travelled. Felix knew that they were caused by rabbits hastening off, or a boar bounding away, yet they increased the feverish excitement with which he was burdened. Though dark beneath the firs, it was not like the darkness of the beeches. These trees did not form a perfect canopy overhead everywhere. In places he could see where a streak of moonlight came aslant through an opening and reached the ground. One such streak fell upon the track ahead. The trees there had decayed and fallen, and a broad band of light lit up the way. As he approached it, and had almost entered, suddenly something shot towards him in the air, a flash, as it were, as if some object had crossed the streak, and was rendered visible for the tenth of a second, like a mote in the sunbeams. At the same instant of time, the horse, which he had pressed to go faster, put his foot into a rut or hole, and stumbled, and Felix was flung so far forward that he only saved himself from being thrown by clinging to his neck. A slight whizzing sound passed over his head, followed immediately by a sharp tap against a tree in his rear. The thing happened in the twinkling of an eye, but he recognised the sound. It was the whiz of a crossbow bolt which had missed his head and buried its point in a fir. The stumble saved him. The bolt would have struck his head or chest had not the horse gone nearly on his knee. The robber had so planned his ambush that his prey should be well seen, distinct in the moonlight, so that his aim might be sure. Recovering himself, the horse, without needing the spur, as if he recognised the danger to his rider, started forward at full speed, and raced, regardless of ruts, along the track. Felix, who had hardly got into his seat again, could for a while but barely restrain it, so wildly he fled. He must have been carried within a few yards of the bandit, but saw nothing. Neither did a second bolt follow him. The crossbow takes time to bend, and if the robber had companions, they were differently armed. He was a furlong or more from the spot before he quite realised the danger he had escaped. His bow was unstrung in his hand, his arrows were all in the quiver. Thus, had the bolt struck him, even if the wound had not been mortal, as it most likely would have been, he could have made no resistance. How foolish to disregard the warnings of the grooms at the castle! It was now too late, all he could do was to ride. Dreading every moment to be thrown, he pushed on as fast as the horse would go. There was no pursuit, and after a mile or so, as he left the firs and entered the ashwoods, he slackened somewhat. It was indeed necessary, for here the hoofs of preceding horsemen had poached the turf, always damp under ash, into mud. It was less dark, for the boughs of the ashes did not meet above. As he passed, wood-pigeons rose with loud clatterings from their roosting-places, and once or twice he saw in the gloom the fiery phosphoric eyeballs of the grey wood-cats. How gladly he recognised presently the change from trees to bushes when he rode out from the thick ashes among the low hawthorns, and knew that he was within a mile or so of the south barrier at home. Already he heard the song of the nightingale, the long note which at night penetrates so far, the nightingale which loves the hawthorn and the neighbourhood of man. Imperceptibly he increased the speed again. The horse, too, knew that he was nearing home, and responded willingly. The track was much broader and fairly good, but he knew that at one spot, where it was marshy, it must be cut up. There he went at the side, almost brushing a projecting maple bush. Something struck the horse. He fancied the rebound of a bough. He jumped, literally jumped, like a buck, and tore along the road. With one foot out of the stirrup, it was with the utmost difficulty he stuck to his seat. He was not riding, but holding on for a moment or two. Presently recovering from the jolt, he endeavoured to check him, but the bit was of no avail. The animal was beside himself with terror, and raced headlong till they reached the barrier. It was, of course, closed, and the warder was asleep, so that until he dismounted and kicked and shouted, no one challenged him. Then the warder, spear in hand, appeared with his lantern, but recognising the voice, ran to the gate. Within the gate a few yards there were the embers of a fire, and round it a bivouac of footmen who had been to the feast, and had returned thus far before nightfall. Hearing the noise, some of them arose and came round him, when one immediately exclaimed and asked if he was wounded. Felix replied that he was not, but looking at his foot where the man pointed, saw that it was covered with blood. But upon close examination there was no cut or incision. He was not hurt. The warder now called to them, and showed a long, deep scratch on the near flank of the horse, from which the blood was dripping. It was such a scratch as might have been made with an iron nail, and without hesitation they all put it down to a bushman's spud. Without doubt, the bushman, hearing Felix approach, had hidden in the maple bush, and as he passed, struck with his nail-like dagger, but miscalculating the speed at which the horse was going, instead of piercing the thigh of the rider, the blow fell on the horse, and the sharp point was dragged along the side. The horse trembled as they touched him.
"Sir," said one of the retainers, their head man, "if you will pardon me, you'd best string your bow and send a shaft through his heart, for he will die in misery before morning."
The bushman's spud, the one he uses for assassination or to dispatch his prey, is poisoned. It is a lingering poison, and takes several hours to produce its effect, but no remedy is known, and many who have escaped from the cowardly blow have crawled to the path only to expire in torture. There was no denying that what the retainer proposed was the only thing that could be done. The warder had meantime brought a bucket of water, of which the poor creature drank eagerly. Felix could not do it. He could not slay the creature which had carried him so long, and which twice that night had saved him, and was now to die, as it were, in his place. He could not consent to it. He led the horse towards home, but he was weak or weary, and could not be got beyond the pen. There the group assembled around him. Felix ordered the scratch to be cleansed, while he ran over in his mind every possible remedy. He gave strict orders that he should not be dispatched, and then hastened to the house. He undid with trembling hands the thongs that bound his chest, and took out his manuscripts, hoping against hope that among the many notes he had made there might be something.
but there was nothing, or in his excitement he overlooked it. Remembering that Oliver was a great authority upon horses, he went into his room and tried to wake him. Oliver, weary with his ride, and not as yet having slept off the effects of the feast, could not be roused. Felix left him and hurried back to the pen. Weary as he was, he watched by the horse till the larks began to sing and the dawn was at hand. As yet he had not shown any severe symptoms except twitching of the limbs and a constant thirst which water could not quench. But suddenly he fell, and the old retainer warned them all to stand away, for he would bite anything that was near. His words were instantly fulfilled. He rolled and kicked and bit at everything within reach. Seeing this agony, Felix could no longer delay. He strung his bow, but he could not fit the arrow to the string. He missed the notch, so much did his hands shake. He motioned to the retainers who had gathered around, and one of them thrust his spear into the horse behind his shoulder. When Felix at last returned to his chamber, he could not but reflect, as the sun rose and the beams entered, that every omen had been against him. The adder underfoot, the bandit's bolt, the bushman's poisoned point. He slept till noon, and upon going out, unrefreshed and still weary, he found that they had already buried the horse, and ordered a mound to be raised above his grave. The day passed slowly. He wandered about the castle and the enclosed grounds, seeking comfort and finding none. His mind vacillated. He recalled all that Aurora had said, persuading him not to do anything in haste or despair. Yet he could not continue in his present condition. Another day went by, and still undecided and doubting, he remained at home. Oliver began to jest at him. Had he abandoned the expedition? Oliver could not understand indecision. Perhaps he did not see so many sides to the question. His mind was always quickly made up. Action was his forte, not thought. The night came, and still Felix lingered, hesitating. End of part 2, chapter 12. Chapter 13 of After London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Ruth Golding. After London or Wild England by Richard Jefferies. Part 2, Wild England. Chapter 13, Sailing Away. But the next morning Felix arose straight from his sleep, resolved to carry out his plan. Without staying to think a moment, without further examination of the various sides of the problem, he started up the instant his eyes unclosed, fully determined upon his voyage. The breath of the bright June morn as he threw open the window shutter filled him with hope. His heart responded to its joyous influence. The excitement which had disturbed his mind had had time to subside. In the still slumber of the night, the strong undercurrent of his thought resumed its course, and he awoke with his will still firmly bent in one direction. When he had dressed, he took his bow and the chest bound with the leathern thongs and went down. It was early, but the Baron had already finished breakfast and gone out to his gardens. The Baroness had not yet appeared. While he was making a hurried breakfast, for having now made up his mind, he was eager to put his resolve into execution, Oliver came in, and seeing the chest and the bow, understood that the hour had arrived. He immediately said he should accompany him to Heron Bay and assist him to start, and went out to order their horses. There were always plenty of riding horses at Old House, as at every fortified mansion, and there was not the least difficulty in getting another for Felix in place of his old favourite. Oliver insisted upon taking the wooden chest, which was rather heavy, before him on the saddle, so that Felix had nothing to carry but his favourite bow. Oliver was surprised that Felix did not first go to the gardens and say good-bye to the Baron, or at least knock on the Baroness's door and bid her farewell. But he made no remark, knowing Felix's proud and occasionally hard temper. Without a word, Felix left the old place. He rode forth from the north barrier, and did not even so much as look behind him. Neither he nor Oliver thought of the events that might happen before they should again meet in the old familiar house. When the circle is once broken up, it is often years before it is reformed. Often, indeed, the members of it never meet again, at least not in the same manner, which perhaps they detested then and ever afterwards regretted. Without one word of farewell, without a glance, Felix rode out into the forest. There was not much conversation on the trail to Heron Bay. The serfs were still there in charge of the canoe, and were glad enough to see their approach, and thus to be relieved from their lonely watch. They launched the canoe with ease, the provisions were put on board, the chest lashed to the mast that it might not be lost. The favourite bow was also fastened upright to the mast for safety, and simply shaking hands with Oliver, Felix pushed out into the creek. He paddled the canoe to the entrance and out into the lake till he arrived where the south-west breeze coming over the forest touched and rippled the water, which by the shore was perfectly calm. Then, hoisting the sail, he put out the larger paddle which answered as a rudder, took his seat, and waving his hand to Oliver, began his voyage. The wind was but light and almost too favourable, for he had determined to sail to the eastward, not for any specific reason, but because there the sun rose, and that was the quarter of light and hope. His canoe, with a long fore-and-aft sail, and so well adapted for working into the wind, was not well rigged for drifting before a breeze, which was what he was now doing. He had merely to keep the canoe before the wind, steering so as to clear the bold headland of White Horse, which rose blue from the water's edge far in front of him. Though the wind was light, the canoe being so taper and sharp at the prow, and the sail so large in comparison, slipped from the shore faster than he at first imagined. As he steered aslant from the little bay outwards into the great lake, the ripples rolling before the wind gradually enlarged into wavelets. These again increased, and in half an hour, as the wind now played upon them over a mile of surface, they seemed in his canoe, with its low freeboard, to be considerable waves. He had purposely refrained from looking back till now, lest they should think he regretted leaving, and in his heart desired to return. But now, feeling that he had really started, he glanced behind. He could see no one. He had forgotten that the spot where they had launched the canoe was at the end of an inlet, and as he sailed away the creek was shut off from view by the shore of the lake. Unable to get to the mouth of the bay because of the underwood and the swampy soil, Oliver had remained gazing in the direction the canoe had taken for a minute or two, absorbed in thought, almost the longest period he had ever wasted in such an occupation, and then, with a whistle, turned to go. The serfs, understanding that they were no longer required, gathered their things together and were shortly on their way home. Oliver, holding Felix's horse by the bridle, had already ridden that way, but he presently halted and waited till the three men overtook him. He then gave the horse into their charge, and turning to the right, along a forest path which branched off there, went to Ponze. Felix could therefore see no one when he looked back, and they were indeed already on their way from the place. He now felt that he was alone, he had parted from the shore and from all the old associations. He was fast passing not only out upon the water, but out into the unknown future. But his spirit no longer vacillated. Now that he was really in the beginning of his long-contemplated enterprise, his natural strength of mind returned. The weakness and irresolution, the hesitation, left him. He became full of his adventure, and thought of nothing else. The south-west breeze, blowing as a man breathes, with alternate rise and fall, now driving him along rapidly till the water bubbled under the prow, now sinking, came over his right shoulder and cooled his cheek, for it was now noon, and the June sun was unchecked by clouds. He could no longer distinguish the shape of the trees on the shore. All the boughs were blended together in one great wood, stretching as far as he could see. On his left there was a chain of islands, some covered with firs, and others only with brushwood, while others again were so low and flat that the waves in stormy weather broke almost over them. As he drew near White Horse, five white terns or sea-swallows flew over. He did not welcome their appearance, as they usually preceded rough gales. The headland, wooded to its ridge, now rose high against the sky. Ash and nut tree and hawthorn had concealed the ancient graven figure of the horse upon its side, but the tradition was not forgotten, and the site retained its name. He had been steering so as just to clear the promontory, but he now remembered that when he had visited the summit of the hill, he had observed that banks and shoals extended far out from the shore and were nearly on a level with the surface of the lake. In a calm they were visible, but waves concealed them, and unless the helmsman recognised the swirl sufficiently early to change his course, they were extremely dangerous. Felix bore more out from the land, and passing fully a mile to the north, left the shoals on his right. On his other hand, there was a sandy and barren island, barely a quarter of a mile distant, upon which he thought he saw the timbers of a wreck. It was quite probable, for the island lay in the track of vessels coasting along the shore. Beyond White Horse, the land fell away in a series of indentations, curving inwards to the south. An inhospitable coast, for the hills came down to the strand, ending abruptly in low but steep chalk cliffs. Many islands of large size stood out on the left, but Felix, not knowing the shape of the lake beyond White Horse, thought it best to follow the trend of the land. He thus found, after about 3 hours, that he had gone far out of his course, for the gulf-like curve of the coast now began to return to the northward, and looking in that direction he saw a merchant vessel under her one square sail of great size standing across the bay. She was about 5 miles distant, and was evidently steering so as to keep just inside the line of the islands. Felix, with some difficulty, steered in a direction to interrupt her. The southwest wind being then immediately aft, his sail did not answer well. Presently he lowered it and paddled till he had turned the course, so that the outrigger was now on the eastern side. Then, hoisting the sail again, he sat at what had before been the prow, and steered a point or so nearer the wind. This improved her sailing, but as the merchant ship had at least 5 miles start, it would take some hours to overtake her. Nor, on reflection, was he at all anxious to come up with her, for mariners were dreaded for their lawless conduct, being, when on a voyage, beyond all jurisdiction. On the one hand, if they saw an opportunity, they did not hesitate to land and pillage a house, or even a hamlet. On the other, those who dwelt anywhere near the shore considered it good sport to light a fire and lure a vessel to her destruction, or, if she was becalmed, to sally out in boats, attack, and perhaps destroy both ship and crew. Hence the many wrecks and losses and the risks of navigation, not so much from natural obstacles, since the innumerable islands and the creeks and inlets of the mainland almost always offered shelter, no matter which way the storm blew, but from the animosity of the coast people. If there was an important harbour and a town where provisions could be obtained or repairs effected, the right of entrance was jealously guarded, and no ship, however pressed by the gale, was permitted to leave, if she had anchored, without payment of a fine. So that vessels as much as possible avoided the harbours and towns and the mainland altogether, sailing along beside the islands, which were for the most part uninhabited, and anchoring under their lee at night. Felix, remembering the character of the mariners, resolved to keep well away from them, but to watch their course as a guide to himself. The mainland now ran abruptly to the north, and the canoe, as he brought her more into the wind, sprang forward at a rapid pace. The outrigger prevented her from making any leeway or heeling over, and the large spread of sail forced her swiftly through the water. He had lost sight of the ship behind some islands, and as he approached these, began to ask himself if he had not better haul down his sail there, as he must now be getting near her, when, to his surprise, on coming close, he saw her great square sail in the middle, as it seemed, of the land. The shore there was flat, the hills which had hitherto bounded it suddenly ceasing. It was overgrown with reeds and flags, and about 2 miles away the dark sail of the merchantman drifted over these, the hull being hidden. He at once knew that he had reached the western mouth of the straits which divide the southern and northern mainland. When he went to see the channel on foot through the forest, he must have struck it a mile or two more to the east, where it wound under the hills. In another half hour he arrived at the opening of the strait. It was about a mile wide, and either shore was quite flat, that on the right for a short distance, the range of downs approaching within 2 miles, that on the left or north was level as far as he could see. He had now again to lower his sail, to get the outrigger on his lee as he turned to the right and steered due east into the channel. So long as the shore was level, he had no difficulty, for the wind drew over it. But when the hills gradually came near and almost overhung the channel, they shut off much of the breeze, and his progress was slow. When it turned and ran narrowing every moment to the south, the wind failed him altogether. On the right shore, wooded hills rose from the water like a wall. On the left it was a perfect plain. He could see nothing of the merchantman, although he knew that she could not sail here, but must be working through with her sweeps. Her heavy hull and bluff bow must make the rowing a slow and laborious process. Therefore she could not be far ahead, but was concealed by the winding of the strait. He lowered the sail, as it was now useless, and began to paddle. In a very short time he found the heat under the hills oppressive when thus working. He had now been afloat between 6 and 7 hours, and must have come fully 30 miles, perhaps rather more than 20 in a straight line, and he felt somewhat weary and cramped from sitting so long in the canoe. Though he paddled hard, he did not seem to make much progress, and at length he recognised that there was a distinct current, which opposed his advance, flowing through the channel from east to west. If he ceased paddling, he found he drifted slowly back. The long aquatic weeds, too, which he passed, all extended their floating streamers westward. We did not know of this current till Felix Aquila observed and recorded it. Tired and hungry, for full of his voyage, he had taken no refreshments since he started, he resolved to land, rest a little while, and then ascend the hill, and see what he could of the channel. He soon reached the shore, the strait having narrowed to less than a mile in width, and ran the canoe on the ground by a bush, to which, on getting out, he attached the painter, The relief of stretching his limbs was so great that it seemed to endow him with fresh strength, and without waiting to eat, he at once climbed the hill. From the top, the remainder of the strait could be easily distinguished, but a short distance from where he stood, it bent again and proceeded due east. End of Part 2, Chapter 13. Chapter 14 of After London. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Ruth Golding. After London, or Wild England, by Richard Jefferies. Part 2, Wild England, Chapter 14, The Straits. The passage contracted there to little over half a mile, but these narrows did not continue far. The shores, having approached thus near each other, quickly receded, till presently they were at least 2 miles apart. The merchant vessel had passed the narrows with the aid of her sweeps, but she moved slowly, and, as it seemed to him, with difficulty. She was about a mile and a half distant, and near the eastern mouth of the strait. As Felix watched, he saw her square sail again raised, showing that she had reached a spot where the hills ceased to shut off the wind. Entering the open lake, she altered her course and sailed away to the north-northeast, following the course of the northern mainland. Looking now eastwards across the lake, he saw a vast and beautiful expanse of water, without island or break of any kind, reaching to the horizon. Northwards and southwards the land fell rapidly away, skirted as usual with islets and shoals, between which and the shore vessels usually voyaged. He had heard of this open water, and it was his intention to sail out into and explore it, but as the sun now began to decline towards the west, he considered that he had better wait till morning, and so have a whole day before him. Meantime he would paddle through the channel, beach the canoe on the islet that stood farthest out, and so start clear on the morrow. Turning now to look back the other way, westward, he was surprised to see a second channel which came almost to the foot of the hill on which he stood, but there ended, and did not connect with the first. The entrance to it was concealed, as he now saw, by an island, past which he must have sailed that afternoon. This second, or blind channel, seemed more familiar to him than the flat and reedy shore at the mouth of the true strait, and he now recognised it as the one to which he had journeyed on foot through the forest. He had not, then, struck the true strait at all. He had sat down and pondered beside this deceptive inlet, thinking that it divided the mainlands. From this discovery he saw how easy it was to be misled in such matters. But it even more fully convinced him of the importance of this uninhabited and neglected place. It seemed like a canal cut on purpose to supply a fort from the lake in the rear with provisions and material, supposing access in front prevented by hostile fleets and armies. A castle, if built near where he stood, would command the channel. Arrows, indeed, could not be shot across, but vessels under the protection of the castle could dispute the passage, obstructed as it could be with floating booms. An invader coming from the north must cross here. For many years past there had been a general feeling that some day such an attempt would be made. Fortifications would be of incalculable value in repelling the hostile hordes and preventing their landing. Who held this strait would possess the key of the lake, and would be master of, or would at least hold the balance between, the kings and republics dotted along the coasts on either hand. No vessel could pass without his permission. It was the most patent illustration of the extremely local horizon, the contracted mental view of the petty kings and their statesmen, who were so concerned about the frontiers of their provinces, and frequently interfered and fought for a single palisaded estate or barony, yet were quite oblivious of the opportunity of empire open here to any who could seize it.
If the governor of such a castle as he imagined built upon the strait had also vessels of war, they could lie in this second channel sheltered from all winds, and ready to sally forth and take an attacking force upon the flank. While he pondered upon these advantages, he could not conceal from himself that he had once sat down and dreamed beside this second inlet, thinking it to be the channel. The doubt arose whether, if he was so easily misled in such a large, tangible and purely physical matter, he might not be deceived also in his ideas, whether, if tested, they might not fail, whether the world was not right and he wrong. The very clearness and many-sided character of his mind often hindered and even checked altogether the best founded of his impressions, the more especially when he, as it were, stood still and thought. In reverie, the subtlety of his mind entangled him. In action, he was almost always right. Action prompted his decision. Descending from the hill, he now took some refreshment, and then pushed out again in the canoe. So powerful was the current in the narrowest part of the strait that it occupied him 2 hours in paddling as many miles. When he was free of the channel, he hoisted sail and directed his course straight out for an island which stood almost opposite the entrance. But as he approached, driven along at a good pace, suddenly the canoe seemed to be seized from beneath. He knew in a moment that he had grounded on soft mud, and sprang up to lower the sail, but before he could do so the canoe came to a standstill on the mud-bank, and the waves following behind, directly she stopped, broke over the stern. Fortunately they were but small, having only a mile or so to roll from the shore, but they flung enough water on board in a few minutes to spoil part of his provisions, and to set everything afloat that was loose on the bottom of the vessel. He was apprehensive lest she should fill, for he now perceived that he had forgotten to provide anything with which to bail her out. Something is always forgotten. Having got the sail down, lest the wind should snap the mast, he tried hard to force the canoe back with his longer paddle, used as a movable rudder. His weight and the resistance of the adhesive mud on which she had driven with much force was too great. He could not shove her off. When he pushed, the paddle sank into the soft bottom and gave him nothing to press against. After struggling for some time, he paused, beginning to fear that his voyage had already reached an end. A minute's thought, more potent than the strength of 10 men, showed him that the canoe required lightening. There was no cargo to throw overboard, nor ballast. He was the only weight. He immediately undressed and let himself overboard at the prow, retaining hold of the stem. His feet sank deep into the ooze. He felt as if, had he let go, he should have gradually gone down into this quicksand of fine mud. By rapidly moving his feet, he managed, however, to push the canoe. She rose considerably so soon as he was out of her, and although he had hold of the prow, still his body was lighter in the water. Pushing, struggling, and pressing forward, he, by sheer impact, as it were, for his feet found no hold in the mud, forced her back by slow degrees. The blows of the waves drove her forward almost as much as he pushed her back. Still, in time, and when his strength was fast decreasing, she did move, and he had the satisfaction of feeling the water deeper beneath him. But when he endeavoured to pull himself into the canoe over the prow, directly his motive power ceased, the waves undid the advance he had achieved, and he had to resume his labour. This time, thinking again, before he attempted to get into the canoe, he turned her sideways to the wind, with the outrigger to leeward. When her sharp prow and rounded keel struck the mud-bank end on, she ran easily along it, but, turned sideways, her length found more resistance, and though the waves sent her some way upon it, she soon...
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.